And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody, welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by The Athletic. I am Marc-Antoine Godin with Arpin Basu. And today, Arpin, on this Monday, November 28th, we've got a special guest.
Yes, Mike Kelly from SportLogic has joined us. You can watch his work on NHL Network regularly, but he's been working in the realm of analytics and hockey analysis for many, many years, more than he would like to admit, I think. Mike, welcome to The Athletic Support. Thanks for being here.
Hey, my pleasure. Yes, more than I would like to admit for sure, but appreciate that.
Yes.
Before we get started, because I know you're based in the Montreal region, so you're exposed to a lot of Montreal Canadiens. Obviously, it's going to be the main topic here today, but just to have an idea for our listeners. So Arpin just mentioned the fact that you work for SportsLogic, but over there, when it comes to, obviously there are a lot of people who have developed the stats, the different metrics that are being analyzed. There are some technical people that develop or try to create an evolution of the systems over there. But how do you go about taking those statistics or those metrics that are generated by SportsLogic and properly interpret them? What's your role in that business?
Yeah, so that's a huge part of it, and a real separator, I think, for companies and people that can do really effective work is the ability to interpret the data, because there's so much of it. And it's like that in any industry, right? It's not specific to hockey or even sport, but the interpretation is a huge part of it. And I think that's the one thing that I've been able to do well, I guess, and is that part of it. And, you know, for me, I oversee what we do with our media division there and our clients in the media that work with us. And without that ability, there's not really much of a demand for statistics or analytics. The interpretation is the biggest part of that. I've been there for over 6 years now at SportLogic, and part of it is just the experience of working with this information day in and day out over multiple seasons, and having enough of a background and being able to understand, data and correlations and things like that, but also being able to work with it every day for multiple years and make mistakes and learn from them and move on and kind of just go through that process hundreds and hundreds of times until you get to a point where you're pretty confident in what you're doing.
You've come to know, I think, Chris Boucher personally. Obviously, Chris Boucher is one of the founders of the NHL department at Sports Logic. Now he's been hired by the Montreal Canadiens. In your dealings with him over the years, how would you describe the type of guy that he is? And as the head of that new analytics department with the Canadiens, what do you think are the main assets that he's bringing to the team?
Yeah, so I think in terms of who was probably available to hire into that job, you couldn't have picked a better person than Chris, given his background. And, you know, he was one of the very, I was employee number 12 at Sport Logic. I was there pretty, you know, not long after the beginning. He was third or fourth. I mean, he was one of the first people there. And he was the hockey guy, right? So we have our CEO, we have our CTO, and Chris was the hockey guy. And even going back before Sport Logic, you know, Chris was taping games on VHS and pausing and playing and manually tracking stuff going back like 15, 20 years ago. So, you know, the kind of guy he's a relentless worker, huge passion for what we're doing in the sport, you know, is from the Montreal area. So, you know, that's a great fit for him. But what impressed me so much about him is just the relentless work ethic that he has to problem solve. And I think the interesting thing with the Canadiens job is that it wasn't just about finding somebody to run an analytics department. It was about finding someone to build an analytics department. And Chris effectively did that at Sport Logic to the point that our company works with almost every team in the NHL. Right. So he is a heck of a person for them to hire into that role. And I'm sure he's going to do great things there.
Yeah. Well, his name actually came up today after practice. Marty St. Louis was asked about, you know, how the coaching staff interacts, with the analytics staff. And so actually let's listen to his answer, 'cause it was pretty interesting.
I think the biggest thing with the analytics is, you know, we're able to, you know, Boosh is full time, so he's around. So we're able to collaborate with him and get some feedback. Now, is it the whole story? I don't think it's the whole story, but it kind of, sometimes it steers us or it keeps us accountable a little bit of, you know, what we think we're doing well. And maybe we're like, oh, it's not as good as we think we're doing it. You know, how do we do it better? You know, because sometimes without the data, you just got the result that you think everything is good. But the data really confirms if things are good and if you, or helps you get things a little bit better on both sides. You know, and sometimes, you know, sometimes it's not as bad as what the red is says, you know. So you got to, you know, it's all how you interpret it, you know. And I think collectively we can come up with some answers based on some of the data that we get, and that helps us steer us in the right direction or navigate us what's next with our group. So it's been a huge, you know, I've never had that, you know, I've never really used that. I've been always fascinated by it, and now I get to really dive in with it, and it's I think it's helped us help us map our routes and how we're going to progress as a team.
So yeah, so that's Boosh, obviously, when he mentions Boosh, is obviously Chris Boucher. And what, Mike, what you were talking about, the ability to interpret the data and put it in a digestible form in order to create a market for it, I think that's exactly what Marty was just talking about. You know, when you don't get much more simple than red means bad and green means good. So it's, you know, he is interpreting the data in its purest, simplest form. But you know, I mean, just if you could speak to the importance of that, because I think that a lot of analytics people, if they had access to a coaching staff, might try to just bog them down with tons of raw numbers or data or a lot of noise, frankly. So his ability to whittle that down into something that's digestible for the coaching staff, I would imagine would be a big factor in anyone's ability to do that job with any degree of success.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, to me, that's not a nice to have thing in somebody in that role. It's a must have. And you know, coaches view the game in a certain way. And I'll be honest, in the years that I've spent working in analytics now, my appreciation for coaches has grown exponentially for how bright they are, how smart they are. You know, you talk about sometimes analytics versus eye test, right? And coaches are so wired into what's going on with their team and have such great insights that can't be quantified, not currently anyways, in a lot of ways. So working together, you know, the way that I imagine Chris and Martin Saint-Louis, we would, and Chris, again, worked with so many of our team clients in his time at SportLogic, that he's got that comfortability of being able to talk to a GM, being able to talk to a coach, a player, and do that effectively. It's huge. And, you know, the color coding that you mentioned there, you know, red is bad, green is good. You have to work with people, right? And if Chris and I are talking, it's probably not a red is bad, green is good conversation. But if he's talking to a head coach, that's a different kind of conversation. And you're trying to get them real pertinent information that they can make actionable. That's all they care about. I've talked to a lot of coaches and they all want to know, how can I win? How can I improve what I'm doing? And if you can give them any information, call it analytics, call it whatever you want, they can help them do that. They will be receptive to it. You know, I think about Rick Tocchet on TNT not that long ago saying he used to get an analytics report and he'd throw it in the garbage. That's not an indictment on analytics. It's an indictment on what he was being presented with. So, like I said, the next time
it's a bit of an indictment on Rick Tocchet.
Well, it might be for, in terms of a growth mindset, in terms of trying to learn new information, maybe. But like I said, you know, I've worked with some coaches where you wouldn't think that they're the analytics, you know, inclined type of people. But if you can effectively communicate something to them that they find interesting or think that can help them win, and Chris has an entire career of doing this, they're going to be open to it.
Yeah, but I think a key also for a guy like Chris presenting information to Martin Saint-Louis, the fact that the coach maybe has just a specific, a really short amount of time probably that he has to dedicate to this. He's got tons of stuff on his plate. It's not dumbing things down by just color coding it. It's also just putting it to a simple, fastest way to treat information, going straight to the main point of it. It's like, you know, I like coffee. I like drinking coffee in different ways. I might like, you might like a latte or whatever. But if you get the short, the corto, the small espresso that's reduced, you know, to the purest way, it's one way also to drink your coffee. Well, the same goes with information. It's still information, but if it's reduced to its simplest form, it's going to be drunk, it's going to be digested fast, and ultimately that's what coaches need.
Yeah, definitely. I don't remember exactly what the quote, it might have been Mark Twain who said to the effect, I'd make it shorter if I had more time, right?
Yes.
So
that same goes for Arpin and I with our articles.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, you guys crank out a lot of material. So
we usually fail miserably with that, but anyway.
But you know what, that is true. And the more concise you can be, I mean, you could go through tons of data and come up with a lot of really interesting things. But you bring up a good point. If you, especially for a coach, you're focused on the next game, a quick summary of what happened, and then the next game every other day. And there's not a lot of time to go through a whole bunch of spreadsheets. So, you know, I remember a coach telling me once that he used to get a 22-page report after every game. No. And he had no chance to go through all of this stuff. So, you know, and he talked about, well, you know, I'm seeing that we're bad at certain things, but I'm not trying to get our team to do those things. You know, we're not a team that's trying to do this. We're trying to do that. So there's a lot of back and forth that needs to happen. I'm sure is happening in the case of Montreal with Chris and Martin, where I'm sure that the coach is telling Chris, you know, hey, this is what I'm trying to get our guys to do. What can we measure here? And Chris can relay that performance. And that's how you work in tandem in a situation like that. And like I said, you know, you can't find a better person to do that than Chris Boucher.
So let's get to the crux of the matter and why we really wanted to talk to you here, Mike, is that, you know, the Canadians, I'm just going to run off some numbers here from off Evolving Hockey. So, you know, obviously publicly available metrics, expected goals, 4% rank in the NHL at 5-on-5. Canadians are 26th at 45.45. You got Corsi 4%, they're 24th at 47.6. Goals 4% at 5-on-5, They're 22nd, 47.17. Goals against per 60, which is just as pure a simple metric as you can get. They're sixth worst in the NHL in that metric, 27th, I should say, at 2.98 per 60 minutes. So you look at all these numbers and you look at their record, and you would tend to believe that something's got to give, that at some point these numbers will be more reflective of their wins and losses on the ice. So when you hear that series of numbers, and there are others I could bring up, does that jive to you? Do you think that there is a regression that's coming with this team, and it's inevitable, and we just have to wait for the moment when it's going
to
come?
Yeah, to some degree, I do think that's true. Their points percentage, I believe, is 548 right now. So mm-hmm. if you're asking, do I think that's what it'll be at the end of the year? No, I don't. I think it'd be lower than that. And everything you brought up there is, you know, kind of pretty much in line with how I view them as well. Whether this is, you know, predictive to future or not, the simple fact is that to this point this season, their shooting talent has been a little bit better than what they're creating, and their goaltending has been a lot better than their team defense. So they're winning some more games than they probably should based on, you know, outperforming the chances they're creating, but then goalies helping them steal games also. And, you know, that's maybe the one thing that with this team, maybe you guys have the best understanding of the market here and the fans here of probably anybody. How much do people appreciate how good the goaltending's been this season? Like, it's, you know, Sam Montembeau is starting to get his name mentioned a lot more now, which is great. It kind of a small sample, 8 games, but still he's been fantastic. But, you know, by our goal saved above expected measure per 60 minutes, the Canadians are third best in the league behind Nashville and the Islanders. So that is no small part of why the record is what it is.
Yeah. Jake Allen started off strong. I felt this even in the games where he would give 3-4 goals a game, he was still, you know, showing strong performances. But Montembeau has been really surprising. He's playing he's playing with a lot more poise in front of his net. He's being more compact, less noise, less unnecessary movements on his in his game. But I wonder, when we talk about Montembeau in particular, you mentioned, Mike, that it's a small sample, but is it legit? I mean, is he for real, or is it just there are some numbers that are screaming like, wait, there's a huge regression that's coming up?
Well, in terms of what he's done this season, there's not really a lot of holes to poke. Like, he's been fantastic. He's definitely, as you guys know, he's not the byproduct of a really strong defensive team. He's saving their bacon, not vice versa. So what he's done this year, again, 8 games, he's performed really well. Goalies with at least 5 games, he's third in goals saved per 60. I did not see that coming. I don't think anybody did. No. And is he for real? Is it legit? Like, so we've got 8 games here. We've got, you know, 63 before that that would say no. He would struggle before this season, I think, to be thought of as a viable backup goalie, let alone anything more. So we'll see. I mean, evaluating goalies is one of the toughest things to do, and there's a lot of people who can do that better than I can. But what he's done to this point this season, it's been fantastic. And you know, one area that I look at that I think has been really impressive is because Montreal, again, they're a leaky defensive team. You know, we've got them dead last in expected goals against all situations. If it wasn't for the Anaheim Ducks, they'd be last in a lot more things. But they're 31st in giving up chances off the rush. They give up a lot in transition. And Montembeau has a 941 save percentage off the rush, which is third best in the league. That is outstanding. Mm-hmm. That there's no way that can be sustainable, I don't think. So, you know, like everything, things are probably going to come down a little bit, but everything he's done to this point this year has been terrific.
Here's what I find interesting about the shooting talent and the goalies is that at 5-on-5, the Canadiens' goaltending has actually kind of come back to earth somewhat. Like, I mean, just based on purely on 5-on-5 save percentage, they're 30th, and they're 30th in the league. But if you look on the penalty kill, they are, I believe they're third in the league, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of save percentage on the penalty kill. So it's and in terms of expected goals versus goals allowed, like they have, I think it's 10.51 expected goals against per 60 based on, again, on Evolving Hockey's model. Their actual goals against per 60 is 7.64. So that's almost three fewer actual goals compared to expected goals. And it's just, it's weird to say that the Canadiens' 5-on-5 performance is being propped up by special teams, particularly their penalty kill, which has been pretty strong of late. But I mean, this just would suggest, like, to what extent can a team's special teams, in your opinion, kind of drive the bus? And for how long can that, how long does that work?
Yeah, that's, it's, I almost look at that as like a two-pronged kind of question where, you know, number one, if your power play, if you can score at a high rate, like any good power play can create chances at a high rate. But penalty kill, you're just a good team defending and you've got a good PK, whether it's structure or skater talent or whatever it is. As you talked about, the penalty kill stuff with the Montreal Canadiens is really being driven by the goalies. That worries me a little bit. It's not the overall penalty kill. So I wouldn't be confident in saying that the PK where it's at now is sustainable at all. And, you know, people have talked about the power play forever. It's not being great for the Habs. So if they're, you know, this isn't their plan, but, you know, if the idea is that the Habs record's going to be propped up by special teams, I think they're in trouble.
Yeah. That expected goal number on the penalty kill, by the way, is second highest in the NHL. So it's expected goal against, I should say. So there is a bit of a red flag there.
Okay. So yeah, regarding expected goals, I mean, you know, different outlets will have their own models, and I really respect the one that's developed at Sports Logic. But when it comes to expected goals, I mean, where chances are, where danger is coming from, and ultimately it can suggest, you know, what we can expect literally from a team going forward. But do they always end up reflecting somewhat reality? And how long can it take between reality and what's expected to meet up? You know, is there, or can there remain a huge gap between what we see and what was expected, and the just either out of sheer luck or just the way the puck bounces, a team can actually go a whole year with outperforming their different expected goals ratios?
Yeah, for sure. It's not likely. So for 32 teams, in a general sense, it's usually a very strong indicator of what you're going to or able to produce offensively or what you allow. And it's not taking goaltending into the equation at either end of the ice, because that is the great variable, right? So it just really looks at chance creation. And as a whole, you know, it's not like one team faces the best three goalies all the time. You know, everybody sees everybody more or less equals out. It's a really good indicator in general. So it would be quite unusual for, like, players can certainly exceed their expected goal total or be underneath it for an entire year. The best shooters in the world, because a lot of expected goal models are based off averages, consistently outperform. You know, Austin Matthews, I think, top of my head, he probably outperforms his expected goal number by 18 to 20% a year, because Austin Matthews shooting a certain shot is different than pretty much anybody else. But it is a great indicator of kind of where things should be. And it's what I use at the start of every season, because, you know, the first 10 games, it's hyper-focused by fans and media, and it's a small sample, and it's easy to lose the forest for the trees if all you're doing is looking at results. So there's always situations at the start of a season, especially where, you know, you'll watch certain teams and say, okay, they're going to be fine. I know they're 1-3-0, they're going to be fine. New Jersey was the one for me this year. They were 0-2. Then they were 2-2. And, you know, I put them in the top five of my power rankings when they were 2-2 at the NHL Network. And people there were looking at me like I was crazy. But that's how you can, you know, kind of see a little bit underneath of what's going on. And in certainly in New Jersey's case, you know, things have leveled out and more for them.
Yeah. Sorry, Lindy, right?
Better be sorry.
Yes.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, I mean, speaking of regression, right? Okay, so listen, we both write at The Athletic. And so as a result, almost every time Nick Suzuki scores a goal, we're like, oh, I thought it was one of the worst contracts in the NHL. Obviously, our colleague Dom Lucician put him on his annual list of 10 worst contracts. I think he was ninth. Also wrote in that piece, by the way, how he thought his model got this one wrong. And that, but he's just putting out the names that his model put out. But having said that, and
everyone remembers that little line too, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah. they remember the nuance of the write-up more than him being on the list. Yeah, that's definitely the priority for everyone. But speaking of regression and everything that we're talking about, I mean, you look at Nick Suzuki's on-ice numbers at 5-on-5. Like, his goals for percentage is 55.8, and his expected goals for percentage is 40.2. On a shooting percentage is 15.76. Like, I mean, he's a great player, and I don't think he's going to be necessarily limited. You know, he's someone I could see outperforming his underlying numbers to some extent, but to this extent seems like there's a bubble that's going to burst at some point. And he's just a fascinating player. The big reason why he wound up on Dom's list and why is because his defensive metrics, for a player who's so kind of intelligent and cerebral and plays a sound defensive game, are not that good and weren't good last year. So he's just a weird case where you watch him play, and he's a real big numbers versus eye test guy, because I watch him play every night and he does special things on the ice. He has a very unique way of seeing the game. His hands and his brain, I feel, are linked in a way that is above average, and does things that the opposing team does not expect on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
But 55.8 goals for versus 40.2 expected goals for, something's there. Like, I mean, there's just something going on. But when you watch him, and you know the numbers, you know, kind of the underlying numbers of his game, but when you watch him play, is he kind of like a guy that maybe is difficult for metrics to sum up, or are the metrics kind of telling us something that we need to listen to here?
Yeah, it's an interesting case that you bring up for sure. He's a great player. We can all agree on that, I think. Is he him individually? Is he outperforming in terms of goals? What, you know, he probably should be. Yeah, he is more than anyone else on the team. So I guess if you want to prove that out, you just find what his, you know, goals per 82 rate is right now and see what it would be at the end of the season. I don't think he's going to keep scoring at the pace that he has, and that's fine. He's scoring on a crazy high number of his shot attempts right now, and shots as well. But that line, you know, with Doc and Caulfield, you're right. They're scoring, in terms of goals for and against is not what the expected is. And I'd be fine saying some of that can be shooting talent. You look at Cole Caulfield and the way that he can score, and some of the plays that those two especially can make together, there can be some degree of that, but to the extent that we've seen, probably not. And that line, you know, I was looking today at lines that have played 100 minutes. There's 49 of them in the league at 5-on-5. And in terms of just scoring efficiency, goals per 20 minutes by these lines, it's fourth in the league. But they're giving up a ton too. Not quite as much, but they're still giving up a lot. So it's a high event line. The Habs can be a high event team. The one way that they can create offense well is off the rush, but they give that and more back. So, It's not surprising to see things a bit squirrely, I guess, with them especially. But Suzuki, when he was first in the league, he put up really good defensive numbers. And a lot of the things that we track and that I value, still good, not as good. But his offense has probably come around a bit more than I might have thought. So still a young player too. But it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next 20 games. I think, to your point, Arpin, things are probably going to level out a little bit.
Arpin was, mentioning different numbers that we can get from publicly available data. At Sports Logic, you have your own set of numbers. I was curious to know to which extent the data that you have access to is obviously it's more developed because there's a lot more metrics that you follow and that you track. But is there a big difference for things like expected goals, for example, or high danger chances or whatnot? Do you see a big difference between what you guys collect compared to what's available publicly?
A difference, yes. Not a big difference to the point that, one model would sit here and say that, Arizona's a cup contender and the other one would say they're not. for the most part, we all know who good and bad players and teams are. But there are slight differences. And in some cases, there are really, meaningful differences. But overall, it's more in line with each other than not. There's the thing with privately tracked data, like the data we have at SportLogic, it's just more granular. So we have, more variables to isolate and put into different models. There are things that we put into an expected goal model as an example that aren't currently publicly available that go beyond, shot location, for instance, where we can look at pre-shot movement, whether there's a screen on a shot or not, the handedness of the shooter, et cetera. So there's more granularity that can go into some of the stuff that we build. But, a lot of the public stuff, it's really good. And it's definitely a lot more right than otherwise. So there's still a lot of value in what's being developed online.
But is there among the... with all the stuff that you put your eyes on a daily basis and the data you see specifically regarding the Montreal Canadiens, are there things that you see that's generated by SportsLogic and you look at the data regarding the Canadiens and say, wait a minute, this is such a big thing. This is such a huge component of who they are right now and the way they perform right now. How come this is not a bigger story? How come nobody's talking about this? Are there signs or metrics that are telling a story right now that nobody's talking about?
That's a great question. Again, because I think you guys are both pretty inclined when it comes to numbers, and you watch the team so much. There's nothing that we're tracking that you're going to completely miss. So I wouldn't say to that extent. We can get a little more in detail on specifics about things that I, find can be interesting storytelling tools. And this is the stuff that we work with our media partners on. I'd love your thoughts on one in particular, because it's kind of confounded me a little bit over the years. But, Montreal, like I said, when it comes to generating offense, they are below average in just about every possible way other than creating off the rush. And, we know that they can play fast and they've got dynamic players and they force turnovers. They can get up the ice quick. Their quick ups are really good. They give up a lot off the rush as well. So they're pretty high event that way. But this goes back to what's puzzling to me a little bit, I guess, is this goes back to when Dominic Ducharme was the coach. This goes back to when Claude Julien was the coach, where they really struggled to generate offense, kind of cycling the puck, moving it in the O zone when defensive teams are set up. Quick strike, they're good. They really struggle that way. And we've seen the Habs go from kind of okay to being in a cup final, to being a bottom team with a lottery pick, to being kind of now average in terms of what they've done. But this thing's always been true, where they've really struggled. I think part of the reason the power play can struggle a bit as well. It seems like when teams are set up defensively, the Habs shoot a lot, but they have trouble generating those meaningful chances if it isn't those quick strike chances.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have a theory on that. I mean, the continuity of it, to some extent, I think that identity of the Canadians came as a result of sort of the ascension of that Deno line, Deno, Tatar, and Gallagher. How incredibly good they were at creating turnovers, creating transition opportunities, scoring on those opportunities. Like you know, they scored the bulk of their goals off the rush, and they kind of drove the bus offensively for this team for a while. And then you look at Nick as the successor to Phil. Is not a similar player necessarily, but I feel he creates chances in a somewhat similar way. You know, and the other thing that always stood out to me, especially on the power play, is they always seem to have like a singular weapon on the power play that they can't create opportunities for. It was PK Subban for a long time. It was Shea Weber after that. Now it's Cole Caulfield, who they're trying to open up for chances. And really, he doesn't score as much on the power play as he should. But, you know, sort of this lack of diversity or lack of multiple options offensively, whether it's 5-on-5 or the power play, I think has really hurt this team. They allow teams to eliminate their number one option, and their number two option is almost never as good. It might be changing now with the, you know, with having Suzuki and Caulfield on the power play at the same time, and the incredible, ridiculously unsustainable frequency with which Nick Suzuki scores on his shots on the power play. But it's, you know, that's always been kind of my theory, is that the team's style of play was predicated on the players that they had, and sort of the lack of kind of really high end offensive talent that they had up and down the lineup, where they had a particular skill set, but not that, led them a while ago to become sort of this team that was entirely focused on pressuring the puck, creating turnovers and scoring off the rush. And now, you know, three coaches later, still seems to be the case. They don't score often on off the cycle, or, you know, all the things that you mentioned. Mm. So it just seems like it's a personnel issue more so than a coincidence that three different coaches coach this way.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. There's some truth to that for sure. And that'll be the next step for them, right? We all kind of know what this year is, and it's great that they're exceeding some expectations. But being able to create offense, you know, in multiple ways is kind of a hallmark of basically mm-hmm. every good team. So we'll have to get there at some point.
I don't think I've seen them being good in the cycle since I start covering that team, honestly. Apart from their Stanley Cup final.
The Kovalev years, they were pretty good. The good Kovalev years, they were good on right. They were good.
That's
on
true.
The cycle. But, that team was. Yeah.
Otherwise, Armia, Perry, and Stahl were good in the playoffs on the cycle. But generally speaking, I don't know if it's just a byproduct of having a small, quick team, and also, you know, that sort of defines the style of play that they're going to have, and they're going to, whenever they get the puck back, they're going to use their speed and try to counterattack quickly, and it's just their style. I don't know, but it'd be good if they would find that balance so that they attack in more than one way.
Mm.
The other kind of confounding thing about what you said is that they create a lot of rush chances, and they score on a lot of rush chances, but they also give up a lot of rush chances. And what I find weird about it is that most of their rush chances are created off turnovers they create thwarting the other team's rush chances. I just said the word rush chances a lot, but I mean, it's basically, you know, their transition defense is what leads to a lot of their transition offense. So you would think the transition defense would be good, but it's not. So it's either high risk or I don't even know what else it could be. I mean, that's basically it. Either they create a turnover or they get burned, and there's nothing in between.
Yeah. And it's not uncommon for teams that generate a lot off the rush to also give a fair amount back. Kind of obvious reasons as to why. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, the best teams in the league this year, because you listen to every team, every coach, whether a new coach just got hired, you know, how do you want your team to play? Whatever it is, you want to play fast, right? Well, up-tempo game, want to play fast. Well, everybody wants mm-hmm. to play fast. Some teams just do it better than others and are able to do it better than others. Some teams have players that allow them to do it better than others. But the best teams, like what amazed me about Colorado for even a year or two before they won the cup recently, they not only created so much off the rush, but they were one of the best teams in terms of rush defense. And I was really fascinated last year covering the West series between Edmonton and Colorado to see what would happen between two teams that were so explosive off the rush. And Colorado's rush defense really was the big factor to me in that series, the way that they were able to shut down guys like McDavid and Dreisaitl and Hyman and all of that. So that's a big part of it. But the Habs, you know, right now, again, I think just given kind of who's on the roster and where they're at, they're probably okay playing these high event games, figuring, you know what, at least that plays to one of our strengths and really our biggest strength offensively. And you hope that your goalie's good enough in the game. You hope you can bury a couple of those chances and come out on the right side of it.
Yeah. Well, eventful games have been also entertaining games. That's one has led to the other. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it helps being able to shut down McDavid and Draisaitl when you have a guy who can move like Kale McCarr and even Devon Taves. I mean, it's just, you know, having a mobile defense, which is crazy, you know, year after one year to the next, you saw the Canadians approach on defense in 2021 and how teams were like, okay, the big bruising stay at home defenseman is back in vogue in the NHL, and Ben Chiarot suddenly a hot trade commodity as a result. But then you have Colorado with that defense where really Eric Johnson's the only one, I guess, who would maybe fit kind of that description. And they're able to get it done that way. So it's, mobility on defense is a whole other topic for a whole other podcast, but yeah, it's,
yeah. Well, and Johnson's a good skater too, right? I know he's kind of long in his career, but he can skate.
Yeah.
Josh Manson plays that physical role for them. McCarr's not small, but he's a best skating defenseman in the league for sure. Like you mentioned, yeah. But yeah, you go back and look at past cup winners and you do notice a theme where you want mobile D for sure, but they're not small. They maybe not the biggest, but they're definitely not small.
This is why the Canadians should feel lucky to have Caden Gooley. Is really what I see the value of Caden Gooley being is that he perfectly fits what you just described.
Yeah.
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 Well, thanks so much, Mike. This was really interesting. And, you know, hopefully our listeners don't get too down on what's to come for the Canadians. And maybe they'll defy expectations. But thanks for putting it all in context for us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. And, you know, kind of like we talked about, at the very least, these are exciting games this team's playing. And so they're a lot of fun to watch. So it's a good energy in the building. You guys are there all the time, but it's fun watching on TV, too.
Yeah. It's great. It's a lot of fun. So thanks again, Mike. If people want to follow you on Twitter, they can read you at Mike Kelly NHL, and obviously we can watch your hits on NHL Network on a consistent basis. So thanks again, and we'll see you at the Bell Center before long, I suppose.
All right. Yeah, that sounds great. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
So thanks everybody, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So Arpin, very interesting conversation with Mike, seeing the game in a different way. And I think that it's always interesting when you have people that are dealing with numbers on a daily basis, but they don't constantly talk in numbers. I mean, he masters them. He knows the rankings. He understands everything. But it's also being able to translate it into words and putting his hockey analyst cap on and not just his data and analyst on.
No. Yeah, Mike's good in the sense that he is a firm believer that there is a marriage, and he's not the only one. And you know, I think this is analytics people get a bad rap as being like, oh, it's, you always hear it's not the end all be all as being the typical response from kind of hockey people when they talk about analytics. And I just want to scream, like, no one's saying it's the end all be all. It's just, it's a piece of information that's important. I think Mike does a great job, particularly on his TV hits, in grabbing, getting information from the data, identifying trends, which is something Marty Saint-Louis we talked about again today, that they're not going to worry about something that happened in a game, but if it happens in five or six games in a row, then they'll sort of attack it. He's good at identifying those trends and demonstrating them through the use of video, which means him watching a lot of video and linking the two, which makes it so much more useful and valuable to not only the viewer, but just in general as a piece of information.
A one-off versus a trend. That's a Martyism that we could have squeezed in last week.
Yeah, I mean, we could have, but I mean, it's not, I don't think that's unique to him, you know? It's like, I think a lot of coaches look at it that way. Yeah, it's not unique to him, but listen, that's why it was, you know, it was interesting to hear Marty talk about analytics today. To what extent, and even he said, you know, they don't have all the answers. Like, again, no one's saying they have all the answers, but he does use them. And he has said in the past that they would be stupid not to. So one thing that kind of goes against the trend of the analytics is you heard Mike talk about how great Sal Montembeau has been this season. He is among the best goalies in the NHL in terms of goals saved above expected, which obviously I don't think anyone should expect him to finish the season that way. But that's what's going on right now. And despite that, Martin St-Louis is coming back with Jake Allen on Tuesday night, saying that he's their number one goalie. This is where the intersection of analytics and actually being a manager of human beings and people come in. Making it clear to Jake Allen that he's the number one goalie after Sam Montembeau went out with back-to-back excellent performances, I think is a very interesting move. And really meant to, I think it recognizes in the big picture, the Canadiens are better off with a Jake Allen who finds his game than they are riding a hot streak with Sam Montembeau and potentially losing Jake Allen mentally or just in terms of his own confidence for a longer period of time. It's really a big picture view of things. And I kind of admired the way he snuffed that right out today. And listen, it was our colleague Jean-François Chaumont who asked him and said, well, I don't expect you to tell us who's starting tomorrow, but would you be tempted to start Montembeau? He really tiptoed around it. Would you be tempted to start Montembeau considering the performances he's given? Marty just came right out and said, Jake's our number one goalie. He's going to go tomorrow. I thought that was pretty impressive. And I think there's a lot more at play there than just who's playing well and who isn't right now.
Absolutely. And Martin St-Louis has been big on nurturing his players' confidence and identifying who needs to be helped in that department, who needs some extra confidence, and how can he give a push to a certain player by putting him in different circumstances. Right now, Samuel Montembeau, he's super happy that he played in two consecutive games. He's not going to be upset by the fact that he's not going to play in a third in a row. I think that it's a lot more important to get Jake Allen back on track. And it's not as if, you know, Allen forgot how to play. I'm sure that he'll be, he should be back on his feet, you know, quite fast. But it's just, we pointed this out at our, you know, in our live room on Friday, but Jake Allen is just a sort of goalie, and it's been the history throughout his career. When he's overworked, when he plays a lot of games, his effectiveness diminishes. So he's a tandem goalie. And in that sense, you know, he's a little bit like Yaroslav Halak used to be, in the sense that if he's the dog running after a bone, he's going to be good. And if he's too entrenched into a number one role, he might have more difficulty. So you balance his usage with a good number two, and that's where Samuel Montembeau's performances come in. But Martin St-Louis, when he's not riding the hot hand is what a coach that needs to win ASAP and wins necessarily tomorrow night. That's what a coach will do. He's going to turn to the hot goalie, but this is not Martin Saint-Louis's frame of mind right now. And it's more about how can we make sure that over a longer period of time, we can get the maximum out of both those guys. And in that sense, I think that it looks pretty good. It's just the Canadians are lucky that with Jake Allen going through a rough patch, they have Montembeau who's jumping on the occasion to say, hey, I am more than the guy that you picked up on waivers last year.
Yeah, and to his credit, he's become more than that through his work with Éric Raymond. You know, I find one area of Montembeau's game that has improved enormously. And he still has games where this pops up. But, you know, his big issue last season, I found, was often rebound control. Like a shot, an inoffensive shot would come in from a great distance, and he would kick the rebound right out into the slot and give up a rebound on a goal. Give up a goal on a rebound, I should say. This happened regularly. And so I find it's not happening quite as much. You know, I mean, either he smothers it or he's able to kick it out, you know, something that Carey Price was masterful at for years, able to kick it out to a corner or a non-dangerous area of the ice. So I asked him if that's been a priority of his, and I found his answer interesting. He said, well, one thing I've focused on is being more compact, which for a bigger guy, you would think, okay, that'd be the opposite. But he's trying to be more compact when the shot comes in to eliminate holes under his arms, just holes in strange places that he needs to have closed up. And so there are fewer goals squeaking through him. And he's not reaching as much, which I think really comes down to footwork and positioning as well. But the side result of that, in his opinion at least, is that he's absorbing more pucks. You know, I loved Mike Babcock's line about Price once at the Olympics, is he kept saying he's soft, which in hockey is the worst insult you can give someone. But when he said soft, he meant absorbent. He meant Price could absorb pucks and not let them get out. Once they've entered his realm, you know, so
it's like shooting on a mattress.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or like, you know, like, or anyhow, roll of really soft toilet paper, I guess, if the ad campaign would be to believe. But, you know, I think Sam felt that was the biggest improvement that he's made, is playing more compact, making sure there aren't as many holes. And the side result is that he's not giving up as many rebounds. So, you know, we've talked about it, and I've been very reluctant to see much of a growth possibility for Sam Montembeau, given he's 25, so he's not old, but he's not exactly young anymore. But if this keeps up, and who knows, I could be wrong, you know, I mean, maybe he's definitely working on his game to try and make it so that he's not a finished product just yet.
Yeah, and I mean, there are, when you take a guy who's entering the league, I mean, he had a couple of cup of coffees in the past, but last year, it was the first time that he reached roughly 15 games at age 25. If you take goalies that have that criteria, that arrive in the league in the sense that they play 15 games in their mid-20s, the goalies, and then they start and have a career, it goes in every direction possible. You have guys that have been flash in the pan that were out of the league in a couple of years. You had guys that just developed into basic number two goalies and never went any further than that. Other guys blossomed into number ones. So it's really an open question. It can go in many various different ways for him. So it's just that we have this notion that because he was so raw when he was playing for the Panthers, because technically there was a lot to clean up, even when he arrived with the Canadians, with the fact that even if he battles and he'll make 40 saves on a certain night, he might give up a bad goal. There was a lot to to criticize from him, so that we would say, oh well, he's not going to amount to much. But it's really nice to see that as time goes on, he forces us into pondering and what he might become, and could he be more? You know, so I don't see necessarily a future number one goalie, but I see a guy that if the Canadians want, as long as the Canadians don't have their goalie of the future, they don't have that surefire number one, they're probably compromise into a tandem situation. And if Montembeault keeps it up, you can go into a tandem situation heading into a season thinking, okay, well, Sam Montembeault and even Jake Allen, that current tandem, we can carry this for 2-3 years and we'll be fine. It's not going to be an area of worry. And when you look at last season, when everything went wrong, well, goaltending went wrong too. And we thought that it was an area of concern. But all of a sudden, it's not anymore.
No, not right now. I'm still going to wait and see where this goes. You know, I think the standard, the bar for this tandem is exactly what you just said, where it won't be an area of concern. It won't be good. Like, I mean, above average. Like, I don't see how long-term this tandem could get you above average goaltending. It is right now. But in any case, not an area of concern is fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And frankly, there's nothing wrong with that. It's until they can find a goaltender who will give them above average goaltending. Goaltending not being an area of concern is a status that I think a lot of teams would take. they would like that. There are a lot of teams that are concerned about their goaltending right now. So not having that as an area of concern is a good thing. And so that's
for less than $5 million a year next year too.
Yeah.
That's exactly. Not an area of concern at a very, very modest price tag.
Yes. So well, let's wrap it up there. I will just leave you with this because I want to make this a theme on the podcast, Marc Antoine. I didn't talk to you about this beforehand, but I would just like to, can you tell me again for the people in the back, how did Nick Suzuki spend his rookie year in the NHL?
He started as a fourth line winger and he was playing alongside Nate Thompson on the fourth line.
So I think until people stop freaking out about Yaroslav Koski being on the fourth line, we're going to end every single podcast, every episode, we will end with a reminder that Nick Suzuki, when he was a rookie and he was 2 years older than Yaroslav Koski is now at the time, played his rookie season as a fourth line winger with Nate Thompson. Can we make that our signature goodbye?
Not sign off.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't. To be clear, he didn't spend a whole year there.
No, he didn't.
But
neither has Juraj Slavkovsky.
No, and I mean, we're 2 months into two months into the season, so it's not to say that this is going to be the reality in March. I honestly doubt that it will be. But still, even if it was, he's still 2 years younger than when Suzuki came in. So yeah, I think that freaking out about Juraj Slavkovsky is just an old reflex that just needs to be washed out and, you know, parked somewhere and say, oh, just old habits. And I know that they die hard, but at some point they must die.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll talk to you on Friday with Luis Paul Gatlicic.